International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome again to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Recently, there's been a lot of reporting going on, especially in the Asia-Pacific region, about the Manus Island Detention Center opened by Australia, which is now closed. This is a place that was opened to house refugees that were on rickety boats making their way to to Australia. Now, in a country with a reputation of violence and lawlessness, Manus Island is considered one of the friendliest and safest places in Papua New Guinea. That's unless you're a refugee or a journalist. Public affairs reporter Liam Fox has spent much of the past 3 weeks covering the closure of the detention center on Manus Island and was the first journalist who managed to get inside and speak to the men there. As he explains, the coup was a result of a rare moment of cooperation with local officials, because reporting on Manus Island is certainly a delicate balance.
In a country with a reputation for violence and lawlessness, Manus Island is considered to be one of the friendliest and safest places in PNG. By and large, it still is, as long as you're not a refugee or asylum seeker or a foreign journalist. Producer Bethany Harriman and I spent nearly 3 weeks on the island covering the events before, during and after the official closure of the Manus Detention Centre on the 31st of October. The attempts by the Australian and PNG governments to maintain a shroud of secrecy around the centre meant it was at times a tense experience. Our first run-in with authorities came when we tried to investigate one of the three so-called transit centres that refugees and asylum seekers are being urged to move to. West Lorengau House, as it's called, is situated in a residential area, and angry locals invited us in to have a look at the place. They drove us in past the security gates, where the guards waved us through without any questions. We got some shots showing construction was still underway and left. But afterwards, while filming at a nearby loading yard, angry security guards accosted us and stole our camera. They told us if we wanted to get it back, we'd have to go to the police station. At the station, the local businessman who owns the land on which the transit centre is being built put his fist to my face while police officers looked on and did nothing. One of his security guards, the one who stole our camera, told Bethany he could make our bodies disappear. The businessman and security guard, not the police, also tried unsuccessfully to make us delete the footage we'd taken. The police let us go with our camera after making us promise not to return to the site. Our next run-in came a couple of days after the closure of the detention centre. We were driving out of the main town Lorengau along the highway when we came across a bizarre sight. A man, clearly a refugee or asylum seeker, was walking along the road heading out of town with two security guards alongside him. They weren't trying to stop him, just walking with him, and there were two police cars, one in front and one behind, guiding traffic around him. We followed the procession for a few kilometres, trying to work out what was going on. It appeared he was trying to walk to the detention centre, some 20 kilometres away. After a while, we drove past and got some shots of the walking man, then turned the car around and waited for him to approach and get more footage. As we waited, members of the police force's notorious mobile squad pulled up beside us. They demanded to know our names and told us in no uncertain terms to leave the immediate area and drive back into town. All this despite the fact we were in a public place, witnessing an event that any passing motorist could see. But given the mobile squad's reputation for beating the crap out of people, we decided not to protest and head back into town. We got the story anyway. Several men inside the detention centre confirmed the man walked back into the centre later that day after he'd left it for one of the transit centres the day before. But it was another example of the ham-fisted way police and security try to suppress information when Manus Island is too small a place to keep secrets. Our time on Manus was not always a tense standoff with officialdom. On the day the detention centre officially closed and Australian officials and contractors flew off the island, PNG immigration authorities allowed us inside to talk to the men who are refusing to leave. We were the first journalists to enter the detention centre in several years. It seemed the immigration officials were in a state of shock following the departure of the Australians and were still working out how to handle the situation. By the next day, the media ban was back in place, and like before, journalists are blocked at the gate to the naval base that surrounds the detention centre. Of course, our experience was nothing compared to the roughly 400 men still inside the detention centre, nearly 3 weeks since power, water, food and medical supplies were cut off. At least journalists can still get to Manus, though getting a journalist visa can be a frustratingly lengthy process. On Nauru, the other part of Australia's offshore processing regime, journalists have to pay a non-refundable $8,000 visa application fee. In these days of tight budgets, few, if any, media organisations can afford to stump up that kind of cash for an application that will be rejected anyway.
And that was Liam Fox reporting. Sir Harry Evans is regarded as one of the world's great newspaper editors. From 1967 to 1981, he edited London's Sunday Times, when it broke a series of big stories, including the exposure of treachery of a Soviet spy, Kiel Fimby, and undercovering the appalling treatment of children and their families who suffered birth defects from the drug thalidomide. In the 1980s, he moved to the United States, where he became the editor-director of the New York Daily News and editor-in-chief of the Atlantic Monthly, before turning his hand to writing history. Now at age 89, after more than 70 years of journalism and publishing, he's disdained it all to learn about writing and editing into a book entitled, Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. Steve Canny reports.
When Sir Harry Evans gives public lectures on the importance of good, clear writing, he likes to play a YouTube video of the people whose job it is to shove commuters into Japanese subway trains during peak hour. It's a metaphor for what he sees as one of the worst sins in writing, trying to cram too much into one sentence. It's time, he says, for writers of all types to cut the crap.
The digital age has made communication so much easier, but it's actually led to a great deal of confusion, verbosity, a convoluted language by which he, which is typical of business leaders, is so wasteful of our time. And one of the reasons why reading is often tiresome is because people who've been doing the writing have been more concerned about their own egos and about the receiver of the words and the information. When I was editing the Times or the Sunday Times, the important thing was, first of all, obviously to find out what the hell was going on, but then to express it clearly so the meaning was unmistakable, was as concise as possible given the fact that everybody was busy.
Sir Harry Evans started his career in journalism as a newspaper reporter in Lancashire in the 1940s. In the 1950s, he travelled through the Deep South in the US, covering the birth of the civil rights movement. He returned to the UK determined to bring back the kind of campaigning journalism that had thrived in the city and regional papers in the US. And when he took over the Sunday Times in 1967, his reporters broke a series of big stories, taking on drug companies, government secrecy, and exposing the truth behind the Bloody Sunday massacre.
Father, how many dead have you seen in the bogside?
Appearing to be dead, there are the three in that Saracen car. There are two men lying at the end of this block of flats. There's another man...
One of his mantras was, it's no use publishing the truth once It has to be part of a long-running campaign. Sir Harry Evans now fears we live in a time when those who tell the truth are under attack.
Attacks on the arbiters of public standards, i.e. academia, experts, which we saw in Britain, the appalling denunciation of experts, Mr. Gove and everybody, during the Brexit debate, suggesting that experts were some kind of against mankind. I'd like to say to them, well, next time you have an operation, I'm going to send my carpenter in to do the brain surgery. He's not an expert, you understand, therefore I think he'll be completely acceptable to you. Those morons trying to deny centuries of advancement in education, science, research and independence and so on, nibbling away at civilized standards are the real enemies of the people. So we've now entered the post-truth society, which has its roots much deeper than Trump. It has its roots in rejectionist, the relativism started with French sociologists suggesting that all truths are relative. And in fact, the Tea Party movement chief spokesman is on record as saying there's no such thing as facts, there are opinions, and people have different opinions, and they're entitled to hold those opinions. Didn't go on to say, but implicitly and even explicitly, doesn't matter what the facts are, opinion can override a fact. Therefore, we're in the post-truth society, and we don't quite know how to deal with it.
Harry Evans had a famous run-in with Rupert Murdoch when the media proprietor bought The Times and Sunday Times in 1981. In the same year, Sir Harry had become the 12th editor in the 200-year history of The Times. He says then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher struck a secret deal with Mr. Murdoch that allowed him to buy the newspapers, avoiding the Monopolies and Mergers Commission, in exchange for what he claims was favourable coverage.
I'll give you the one example, which is classic. The Treasury Chancellor, Geoffrey Howe, suggested the recession was ending, so we reported that. In the business pages, the next figures that came out from the Treasury, from the Chancellor's figures, showed that the recession was not ending, it was continuing. Gross domestic product had fallen but even further. So we put that in as a news piece. The next day, through Mr. Murdoch's consigliere or chief executive, Gerald Long, sent me a note saying, you will not report this kind of thing. You cannot report things which go against what the government has said. How dare you do this? And that was the beginning of unrelenting pressure not to publish or do any criticism of any significant nature, always prefaced by the, I'm not telling you to do this, P.S. you'd be a bloody fool if you didn't do what I'm saying.
Rupert Murdoch told the Leveson Inquiry he sacked Harry Evans after he was told he was facing a staff rebellion at the Times, and that his then editor tried to tell him what kind of editorial line his paper should be taking. Sir Harry accused Mr. Murdoch at the time of spectacular displays of imagination. Even before the post-truth era, the truth was something that was often contested.
Certainly a very interesting story there about Harry Evans. Anyway, you are listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, I just want to tell you about some of the upcoming holiday programs and schedule that we have for the month of December.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Corey 105, it is PD 222 Journal.
Speed 220, Corey 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Well, December and Christmas and New Year's is actually just around the corner, and we actually have some special programs coming up for the month of December. Those programs are four. four dates, in fact. Sorry, three dates. December 9th and December 16th. There's going to be two special editions of Media Network Plus. We return to a regular program on the 23rd. Well, sort of regular, because Christmas is only on the a few days later, on the 25th. So we're going to have our annual Christmas program. And then another special program on the 30th of December. So the four shows for the month of December are all going to be special ones. Now, for our partner stations, because we are going to be preparing these programs in advance, they will have the programs well in advance. And it could happen, which has actually happened before, where programs were broadcast on days that they shouldn't have been broadcast, and they got them mixed up. So hopefully this won't happen again this year. But anyway, we'll keep our fingers crossed. This past week, I posted on the PCJ Media Network Plus Facebook page that terrestrial television is dead. Now, for myself, and I'll be totally honest with you, I have not watched terrestrial television in probably at least 8 years. For news, live sporting events, and television, dramas and comedies, I do most of my viewing now through streaming and on demand. Now, of course, a lot of people would disagree with me on this, but broadcast television as we know it is in fact dying. Let's take Australia as an example. This past week, Nielsen Digital Content decided to do a survey to find out how many people were watching the major networks in Australia. And they chose a 1 week, and they found that during the course of the week, none of them could even get 1 million listeners. But they found out last year, 14 million Australians were watching an average of 21 hours a month through YouTube and other video streaming services such as Netflix and Amazon Prime. To find out more about this, Fran Kelly spoke to the technology editor for RN Breakfast, Peter Marks.
Peter Marks is our technology editor. Peter, hello there.
Hello, Fran.
So YouTube has released this data this week, this report, which shows that more Australians than ever are turning to its channels for video content. Is broadcast TV dead for the next generation? Is that what we're saying here?
Well, not yet. According to a recent ACMA report, the TV set is still the most popular device for kids to view children's programs, but 68% of Australian children aged from 0 to 14 watch children's programs on internet platforms such as YouTube. And as you referred to earlier, that was a Nielsen Digital Content Ratings report last year saying that 14.7 million Australians spent an average of 21 hours a month watching YouTube, and that's almost double what it was 10 years earlier. So YouTube is undoubtedly displacing other video media.
Okay, and what top channels are Australians watching on YouTube?
Well, it's not what you would have expected. The top channel is How To Basic with 9 million subscribers.
And what's that one called? How To?
How To Basic. It's kind of a how-to channel, and it's rather satirical, yeah, instructional videos. Quite weird. Then there's Wenji, also with 9 million subscribers, where a young woman wearing cat ears in a sort of a cartoon bedroom world is presenting life hacks. There's Planet Dolan with 5 million subscriptions, which is animated videos on topics on things like how to cheat on tests. So this is another world that is outside what we would see on broadcast TV. Now, some of these channels have over a billion views, and they clearly make a good living out of the ads shown with their content. But to put it in a global context, the most successful YouTuber is someone called PewDiePie, and he's got nearly 12 billion views, which must be eye-wateringly tempting for current broadcasters. Now, in this
week's
report,
I'm ashamed to say I don't know what PewDiePie is or does. What does PewDiePie do or look like?
Look, he's just a very groovy-looking guy, but what a huge audience the guy's got. I mean, when he goes on TV, night TV shows in America, he's got a bigger audience than any of those shows. But look, in this week's report, YouTube says that last year, more than 100 Australian YouTube channels earned over $100,000 each, mostly from advertising. So there's a good living there for some Australians. But amongst the videos popular with kids are some that are not appropriate.
In what way? I know there is concern about the distribution of some disturbing content targeting kids? Is. What's going on out there?
Well, look, there was a recent Medium blog post by writer James Bridle highlighting unsettling videos aimed at youngsters, and they show popular characters like Peppa Pig, Frozen's Elsa, and Marvel superheroes acting out violent, sometimes sexually suggestive themes.
No.
He says, quote, "Someone or something or some combination of people and things is using YouTube to systematically frighten, traumatise and abuse children automatically and at scale." So these disturbing videos like Peppa Pig include things like Peppa eating her father or drinking bleach. And it turns out these are quite widespread.
So the danger of this is your kids putting in Peppa Pig and you think that's safe and you look at putting Peppa
Pig.
And but somewhere in that list comes this.
Exactly. And it looks out on the surface like a normal sort of video. Now, I raised this with YouTube last night and spokesperson Nick Hopkins replied, quote, "The YouTube kids team, many of whom are parents themselves, care deeply about this. It's extremely important for us to get this right, and we act quickly when videos are brought to our attention. We use a combination of machine learning algorithms and community flagging to determine the content in the app as well as which content runs ads." So what can we do is, I guess, monitor what children are watching closely, because on the surface it can look okay, and report inappropriate content when you see it.
Okay, so they're promising to interrupt or disrupt there. Of course, YouTube's also been used by governments to suppress opposition, meddle in elections. Some of the, Google and Facebook have been hauled before US committees recently. What can YouTube or other user-generated content sites do to fight that?
Yeah, and it's not just the US. New data out this week from Freedom House reports that online manipulation and disinformation tactics played an important role in elections in at least 18 countries over the last year. So it's not just the US. They note that governments around the world have dramatically increased their efforts to manipulate information on social media, and automated content evaluation is battling automated content generation. So the solution might be more human evaluation, but of course a large staff can simply be overwhelmed by the amount of content, and of course there's collateral damage where good content is mistakenly blocked. That's also a problem. Look, it's one of the big challenges of our new digital media age, and I think the first step is recognising the problem.
Okay, just Pete, before you go, are people watching YouTube on their computers, laptops, or are they watching it on their TVs?
Some are watching it on TVs. I think amongst kids, though, it's mostly on, handed down mobile devices or tablets. So really, the TV is losing its prominence in the household.
All right, Peter, thank you very much.
Alrighty, well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation and our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser, to tell us what's been happening and what we can expect propagation-wise over the next 7 days.
Keith from Space Weather Services Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through November 25th. Normal at low latitude bands, normal to fair at middle and high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through November 25th. Magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through November 26th, solar activity very low, no sunspots visible or expected. Geomagnetic conditions mainly quiet to unsettled. Possible active intervals of planetary K indices of 4, or a slight chance of 5 on the 26th with a minor G1 storm. From FK Yanda of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on November 24th to 28th, December 2nd and 9th. Mostly quiet on November 29th and December 8th. Quiet to active on November 30th, December 4th, 7th, 12th and 13th. Quiet to unsettled on December 1st, 3rd, 11th, and 12th. Active to disturbed on December 5th and 6th. From the Space Environment Prediction Center, China, the planetary A index predicted from 2 to 6 until December 4th, when it jumps to 29. Another peak up to 13 on December 12th, and 23 on December 18th. Solar flux varying only slightly between 74 and 70 through December 19th. From the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado, solar flux dropping from 75 December 26th to 68 December 4th, and back up to 75 by December 14th. Geomagnetic field will, with G1 minor storm levels likely, December 4th to 7th, boosting to G2 moderate storms December 4th and 5th, with A and K indices peaking at 40 and 6 on the 5th. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2. November 24th to 28th, December 1st to 3rd, 9th, 10th, 15th, and 16th.
All right, thank you very much, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International, heard through PCJ Radio International and the World Radio Network. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus. No, it isn't. That's for another program. It's MNP at PCJmedia.com. That's MNP at PCJmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. Saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.